Good evening. Theresa May steps down. A new video of Sandra Bland's traffic stop surfaces and the life of Gilbert Baker, the Betsy Ross of the LGBT movement. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Friday, May 24th, 2019. Theresa May ended her failed three-year quest to lead Britain out of the European Union on Friday, announcing that she will step down as Conservative Party leader June 7th and triggering a contest to choose a new prime minister who will try to complete Brexit. May will stay on as a caretaker prime minister until the new leader is chosen in late July. The new party leader will become prime minister without the need for a general election. May was brought down by Brexit, but her nemesis was her own Conservative Party. Her plan to leave the EU was defeated three times in Parliament, rejected both by pro-EU opposition lawmakers and by Brexit-supporting Conservatives who thought it kept Britain too closely bound to the bloc. May defended her record, saying, "I've done everything I can to convince MPs to back that deal," she said. "Sadly, I've not been able to do so. It's now clear to me that it is in the best interests of the country for a new prime minister to lead the effort." The early frontrunner to place May is Boris Johnson, a former foreign secretary and strong champion of Brexit. Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, an opponent of Brexit, tweeted that May's exit will not solve the Brexit mess that the Tories have created. The prospect of an even more hardline Brexiteer now becoming PM and threatening a no-deal exit is deeply concerning. And Texas authorities on Friday denied withholding a cell phone video of Sandra Bland's confrontational traffic stop, responding to heated questions about why the 39-second clip never publicly surfaced until now. Bland, a 28-year-old black woman from outside Chicago, had used her phone in 2015 to briefly film a white state trooper as he drew a stun gun and yelled, "I will light you up," while ordering her out of her car. She was dead 3 days later, hanging in her jail cell outside Houston. The video had not been publicly seen until it was aired this month by a Dallas television station, and both lawmakers and Bland's family say they had never seen the clip. They say the video proves that Trooper Brian Encina had no reason to fear for his life and question whether he should have faced charges beyond perjury. Bland's mother, Geneva Reed Veal of Chicago, attended the hearing at the Texas Capitol but did not testify. She told reporters afterwards she heard a lot of discrepancies at the hearing but declined further comment. And Cena, the trooper, was fired after being indicted for perjury and said he came to fear for his safety after stopping Bland for failing to signal a lane change. The perjury charge was later dropped in exchange for Encina agreeing to never work in law enforcement again. Meanwhile, in New York, preliminary results from a study of lead contamination in drinking fountains in city parks found at least one fountain in Pelham Bay Park with 50 times as much lead in it as permitted by state regulations, by federal regulations. The New York City Department of Parks and Recreation has published early results from its program to test for lead contamination at its public drinking fountains. And while many of the numbers are alarming, they're also very common for cities with aging lead-based plumbing. That's according to Mark Edwards, a civil engineer at Virginia Tech who helped uncover harmful lead levels in Flint, Michigan. Edwards spoke with WBAI Friday. He says the city is doing good work uncovering a long-standing problem.
Any pipe that was built before about 1986 has lead solder used to glue the metal joints together, and so that can be quite hazardous, and we were actually adding some lead purposefully to the plumbing as recently as 2014 to make very intricate small parts. So if anything before 1986 is considered to be a high risk.
Why wasn't that considered dangerous up until such a recent time?
Well, back in the day, we were all kind of intoxicated with lead. Lead was in gasoline. Lead was in our food, tin food. Lead was in our drinking water. Lead was in paint. And so we phased lead out of all those products around the same time from between the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, and we're continuing that battle to the present day. But there was plenty of lead in plumbing through 86, that's for sure.
When was it discovered that lead was a danger, and what kind of danger does it pose to people?
It was actually the first environmental toxin that we knew could hurt people. This goes back to the Roman days, and unfortunately that knowledge was lost in the Dark Ages. We had to relearn it the hard ways. The Romans noticed very high death rates of slaves that manufactured their lead pipes, and of course they had the dementia from being overly lead exposed, and It's unfortunately we didn't learn the lesson the first time, but yeah, the more we've looked at this problem, the levels that we once considered safe for lead exposure are certainly anything but that. And even as blood lead levels plunge in children due to phasing lead out of all those products and doing much better protecting ourselves from it, recent scientific evidence seems to show that even the lower levels of lead are still causing significant harm. So we're still concerned, and it's good news that New York City is getting the lead out of its drinking water.
You mentioned children several times. Is it a particular threat to children, and what kind of threat is it to children?
It's a threat to everyone. Lead does nobody any good. It adversely affects every system in the human body, but it's particularly our youngest children, the developing fetus, and children below age 6, where their nervous system is developing, they're at greatest risk of lead exposure.
You worked on the discovery of lead in the water system in Flint, Michigan?
Yes, I actually helped expose lead in water crises in Washington, D.C., Flint, and a few other places around the country.
We have lead in parks. You mentioned children. All people are adversely affected, children in particular. We have lead now in our parks, and now we have lead seems in our schools. I've heard that school water fountains also have been testing positive for lead in some circumstances. What does that mean? How should the city deal with that?
Lead has always been in our schools. It's been a huge problem, and I'm so excited that New York City and New York State in particular are being very aggressive about sampling and getting those problems fixed. You can't undo the harm that's done. You can only prevent future harmful exposures, and New York is being amongst the more aggressive states in the country trying to get this problem under control.
What should they do? What do you think they should do if you were a decision maker here?
Well, I think they're doing the right thing, testing, finding the problems, and ultimately fixing those taps that pose the greatest hazard.
Is that going to take a lot of work and a lot of money to rip up all the plumbing? Is that what they have to do? And also there's residential lead as well, besides that, and paint in the plumbing as well. What are they going to have to do? Is this a massive reconstruction job?
It certainly is, and I think the testing approach is a way of triage, wherein you're identifying the most at-risk taps, and hopefully you're getting those taken out of service. And as the plumbing degrades and lead starts to, you know, fall, flake off, you might eventually identify that other taps need to be fixed as well. So since we don't have enough money to fix all the problems we face as a society, nor do we have the money to replace all the lead pipes, this is a way of dealing with the greatest risk first.
For all of us popping around town every day, what should we keep in the back of our minds when we bend over for a drink of water at a fountain?
We should just applaud the fact that we're identifying this problem and getting it fixed, at least the worst of these problems, and there's risk from everything we do, and certainly this is a risk that was avoidable, and I'm glad they're getting on top of it.
Mark Edwards is a civil engineer at Virginia Tech who helped uncover harmful lead levels in Flint, Michigan. Sampling in New York City parks and playgrounds started on May 6th in Queens. All of the city's 3,500-plus public fountains are scheduled to be tested by June 14th. At the Dry Harbor Playground in Forest Park in Queens, a drinking fountain where children regularly play came in at 296 parts per billion, nearly 20 times the federal standard. About half of all the fountains tested show levels above the minimum recommended by the American Academy of Pediatrics. And on June 30th, the annual World Pride Parade held in New York City to celebrate LGBT rights and culture will mark 50 years since the Stonewall Uprising in Greenwich Village. It's often marked as the watershed event in the struggle for gay rights. Thousands are expected to march in colorful costumes, dancing, cavorting, partying, and having a good time, and flying the seven-colored rainbow flag, even as LGBT people face repression and increased repression throughout the world. A new book to be released on June 4th tracks one of the seminal personalities in the modern LGBT movement. It's titled Rainbow Warrior, My Life in Color. The book chronicles the life of Gilbert Baker, the so-called Betsy Ross of gay rights, who developed the now ubiquitous rainbow flag. WBAI spoke with his longtime friend, Charlie Beale, who helped edit Baker's autobiography.
Harvey Milk in 1977 asked Gilbert to come up with something better. And he came up with the idea first of a flag, because they were really talking abstractly about symbols. And he saw how powerful flags were during the bicentennial in 1976, you know, that people would literally march into battle and die under a flag representing a thought, an idea, an ideal. He thought we needed a flag. It was an experience he had one night when he was out with his friend Cleve Jones looking at the diversity of crowd when they were out dancing at the Winterland Ballroom, that he thought about the diversity of our community and thought that a rainbow represented that diversity in terms of all different kinds of people within the LGBT community. That's how he came up with the idea, and that's what the flag means.
What are the colors in the original rainbow flag as envisioned by Gilbert Baker?
I original flag had 8 colors. It was pink for sex, red for love, orange for healing, yellow for sunlight, green for serenity, and green for nature, and onward until, I'm trying to get it right here, purple for serenity, turquoise for magic. I think I skipped a color there, Paul. I hope you don't mind. The year after he created the flag, he went to a place called Paramount Flag Company. They had helped him reinforce the original flags. He was worried they were going to rip in the wind that day, and they would have. He got a grant from the city and the parade committee to make 400 flags to fly up and down Market Street in 1979. So he went to, this is a commercial job, he went back to Paramount Flag, and they said, listen, we're going to run out of pink and turquoise. These aren't flag colors. Back then, flag companies carried limited palette of colors, red, white, and blue, yellow, green, you know, for the different national flags, the different state flags. Nowadays, it's different. With digital printing, you could do all the colors. But back then, to make it commercially available, they dropped the pink and the turquoise. But, you know, in 2003, he brought them back, and he brought the 8-color flag back. And he kept using it ever since because technology caught up to the meaning of the flag.
Gilbert really was behind these gigantic flags. Tell us a little bit about these mega flags that we saw here in New York and I heard down in Florida and different places.
Gilbert had been doing a lot through the 80s. He did a lot of different activism. He was a sister of Perpetual Indulgence, but he kind of felt like he needed to do something big to re-energize the flag, especially through the 80s with the Reagan era and AIDS. And he had the idea to do a mile-long rainbow flag, and he, with Cleve Jones' help, they received funding, and he made that flag here in New York. That's when I met him, over at my oldest brother, Dana Beale's house. They were all activists. They all knew each other, and I met Gilbert then, and we became fast friends, and I helped him all the way through that process. And they unfurled that mile-long flag on June 28, 1994 for Stonewall 25. And it was, as they unfurled it, after it was unfurled, he actually cut it into pieces. And some of those pieces went around the world, which kind of made a big upswing in the internationalization of the flag. They didn't adapt the flag in New York City until 1986. There's an article in the New York Native about that, where the parade committee adopted the rainbow flag in 1986. But in 1994, even though it was starting to be seen around the world, when he sent these 200-foot sections of rainbow flags, giant sections of a giant flag, he sent them to Cuba and China and London and Paris and Brazil. And the very next year, all these places are carrying big rainbow flags in all over the world, and suddenly a national symbol became a international symbol, something that just kept growing and growing.
Was there any connection with, there was the Rainbow Coalition, Jesse Jackson? Rainbow started to be used a lot to represent anything that was diverse, whether it was or not.
That's very interesting. Well, Gilbert's flag came first, but I am going to be one of the first people to say that the Rainbow People's Gathering started in 1971, as you know. These are a lot of our hippie friends that go out in the woods and have a gathering every year. Garrick Beck and people like that organize that. So they use the rainbow. The rainbow was used, obviously, before the LGBTQ flag. But I think when Gilbert chose it as a symbol, it became the LGBTQ rainbow flag. The Jesse Jackson Coalition came later. Gilbert always loved when everybody used it. He never felt like it was exclusive. He never wanted to copyright it in the 80s. They wanted to add a black stripe for AIDS, and they said, we'll finally take the black stripe away from the rainbow flag when AIDS is cured. After Gilbert died, the people in Philly added the black and the brown stripe for social justice. But, you know, he loved all that. He wanted people to adapt and use the flag. Mm-hmm. as long as I think it was went along with those original meanings. The colors do not represent gay, lesbian, straight, bi, or anything like that. You know, we have all our little alphabet nowadays. It represented values that all of the people in our community share. If people want to use the flag and use the rainbow and adapt it as a way of fighting for social justice that he believed in, great. I think the original color and the original meanings are timeless.
Tell us about the book.
When Gilbert died, he left behind, I ended up with his hard drive, and he left behind a memoir that we ended up titling Rainbow Warrior. He had many titles for it, but this is the title that kind of pleased the publisher and the agent and all these people. He had done drafts in 95, 98, 2008, and 2012. My partner, Jay Blotcher, who is a well-known editor in our community and was a publicist for ACT UP, Jay and I just sifted through all these different chapters and these different versions and basically just kind of put them together into what we felt was the best of, you know, the best version of the Bobby Campbell story, the best version of the 1994 Mylong Flag story. We didn't really write hardly anything. We would add a word or a date here and there just to make it clear. We did some editing and rearranging for timeline, but if you read it, you really hear his voice. It's him. It's getting published by Chicago Review Press. It comes out June 4th.
What would Gilbert think today in this age of Donald Trump?
He did two big artworks after Donald Trump was elected. First, he did a big Pussy Power banner for the first Women's March. He did a series of Holocaust prisoner uniforms with large pink triangles on them. And he hung them all on a rack, and they were displayed at the Art on Castro art space in San Francisco, hanging on a rack as if to say, here's your, you know, your outfit is waiting for you, meaning if we really let Donald Trump get away with anything, we were all going to be prisoners in some kind of concentration camp. And then in the last month of his life, he, for the 39th anniversary, he created a 9-color flag. He added a lavender stripe for diversity. He created 60 of these hand-sewn flags that we do have a few of. So he even left behind a final flag before he passed away. But he was very alarmed about Trump and the nonsense that was going to follow from his election.
Charlie Beal, who helped edit Gilbert Baker's memoir, Rainbow Warrior, My Life in Color. The book will be released on June 4th. And this is Memorial Day weekend, a time to remember those who died in America's wars. Flags will be placed on graves. Tourists and loved ones will flock to Arlington National Cemetery and the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C. But for Al Gutowski, a member of Vietnam Veterans Against the War, who spent a decade in jail in the 1970s for defecting to Cambodia with a boatload of napalm, was originally bound for the Vietnam War, the current president and his threats against Venezuela are a new development.
I was a civilian merchant sailor transporting explosives into Vietnam. I was there in 67, I believe it was, during the winter, and 67, early 68, I believe. And that was the first trip I went to. And then I came back and was totally against the war and went back in 1970 and mutinied on board a ship with my, my officers. We commandeered a ship full of napalm, 10,000 tons, and took it to Cambodia.
Tell me a little bit about that so I get some background. What was that like?
What was it like? Oh, God. Well, it was just what I did. I was a an anti-war activist, myself and my comrade, and we both made the decision before we went on the ship that we were not going to allow the cargo to reach its designation.
And then what happened on board the ship?
We seized the vessel, and after we seized it, we when we opened communications, we asked for political asylum from Cambodia, the Cambodian government, and we were granted political asylum, and we steamed the ship there and dropped anchor. And a few days later, we were put under arrest when a military coup took place. The U.S., I believe that the U.S. was involved in the coup with military people, similar to what they're doing right now in Venezuela, you know, where they try to approach all the military people to back their play and not respect the neutrality in that particular case of Cambodia.
What happened to you eventually in Cambodia?
Eventually, my comrade was able to escape and was later captured by the Khmer Rouge and executed. Myself, I surrendered myself to the U.S. Embassy, came back to the United States, and was sentenced to 10 years in the penitentiary and served my time.
Looking back on that, do you think that was the right thing to do?
It was absolutely the correct moral thing to do. It was correct. We were illegally at war, dropping bombs, napalm in particular, in Laos and Cambodia against farmers and causing just unheard of devastation. That was later documented as one of the articles of impeachment, one of the original articles of impeachment for the President of the United States, Richard Milhous Nixon.
Do you see any parallels between Richard Nixon and your experience in Vietnam, Cambodia, and what's happening now with Donald Trump and his government?
Yes, I do. It's a we're looking at a situation in Venezuela where we've manipulated the infrastructure. We've terminated electricity. We've terminated either through water supplies, either through direct manipulation electronically, or through supporting people that would commit sabotage. It's a similar situation. The U.S. moves in and buys out whoever they can find to take over if they want to overthrow a government. And that's what they've done historically in many different countries in this world.
What's the message you want to give to other soldiers, other veterans who are there, you know, other future veterans who are now active duty soldiers if they're sent to the Middle East or to Venezuela?
We should resist every effort to begin a war in a country that we that has a legitimate government that was voted into power. We're not saying that Maduro is the person that should be there or the other person should be there. What we're saying is that there was a legitimate government that was voted in power and that we have to follow legitimate rules that are set down by the Geneva Accords and the Geneva Conventions and treaties that the United States honors. Well, apparently the U.S. doesn't honor that treaty or any of those treaties. In fact, they've allowed something historic to occur. They've allowed a non-entity government that they have set up themselves to enter into the U.S., into the Venezuelan embassy in the Washington, D.C., in the capital of the United States. The military is trying to recruit at a young age and doing great propaganda work, showing young children that are under 5 or under 7 or under 12 just how important it is to learn how to salute, stand at attention, and these are the things that we do. We're soldiers. We're here to protect you. The reality is, in Vietnam at least, was that we were not there in Vietnam to protect Americans. We were there to protect capital and capitalism. And basically what has occurred is the U.S. military is now being used as gangsters for capitalism. I would believe that a lot of the soldiers and people that are in the military are thinking people. They want to think, and they really do try. That's not everybody, but a lot of them. And they want for the best. They really want to serve their country, and they really want to protect it. That's their oath. But what I'm seeing is that we're being misled, and we're being misled hugely to the idea and the concept of perpetual war. And now we're going to possibly be into two more. It's going to be real interesting.
Al Gutowski, a member of Vietnam Veterans Against the War, speaking about his experiences during the Vietnam War and the need for political activism against the wars of Donald Trump. And that's some of the news for Friday, May 24th, 2019. The news was engineered by Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul D'Arienzo. Thanks for joining us.